Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 548, Tibet or Not Tibet. This is being recorded on August 16th of the year 2006. Once again, we're going to be taking a look at the gulf between the reality of the Dalai Lama as a political animal and the general perception that exists about him, one that has been deliberately created. We're going to review a very, very short statement from Christopher Hitchens, this specifically made in an article in Ceylon magazine from 1998 by Hitchens about the Dalai Lama, etc. And in that, Hitchens notes quite correctly, "The greatest triumph that modern public relations can offer is the transcendent success of having your words and actions judged by your reputation rather than the other way around." And in the case of the Dalai Lama, he is someone that goes out of his way to mislead about some of the realities in which he engages. We're going to review, or actually we're going to present very quickly, yet another statement from Victor and Victoria Tremonti, a pseudonym, former very close professional and religious associates of the Dalai Lama, and they have evolved into some of his sharpest critics. In an interview with James C. Stevens from September 11th of 2003, they say, or the Tremonti state, "Frankly speaking, the Dalai Lama has two faces. He makes his official contact with the West under the maxim of Mahayana Buddhism and then deftly assimilates the highest values and ideals of Western culture, Christian, Jewish, and humanist. On his present trip to America, he has met with Muslims like Muhammad Ali, Jesuits at the University of San Francisco, political leaders from Republican and Democratic persuasions, and then will comfortably meet with ethicists and scientists at MIT and Harvard. Through diplomatic tolerance, he wins agnostics as well as the hearts of unsuspecting Jews and Christians to whom he preaches in the tongue of a man of peace, unquote, and as a human rights activist relates passages of, quote, compassion, love, and nonviolence, unquote, from the Sermon on the Mount. Nearly all of the speeches the Dalai Lama delivers in public are extremely tolerant, human, and compassionate. You can only agree. Yet there is another face that peeks out from behind the mask of goodness, charity, and kindness, which gives one pause to think more deeply about the shadow of this man of peace," unquote. Last week, we talked about a couple of SS officers. One of them is tutor, the Dalai Lama's tutor, Heinrich Harrer. The other, the top anthropologist at the SS 1938 expedition to Tibet, a guy named Dr. Bruno Begay, who's also very close to the Dalai Lama. Begay, who died in 1998, was a war criminal, having done some ghastly experiments at Auschwitz. We talked about that last week. The two men, Heinrich Harrer and Bruno Begay, the two SS officers, were two of seven people assembled by the Dalai Lama under the auspices of the Tibetan government in exile to relate happy anecdotes about the Tibet of old, the Tibet before the Chinese invasion. As I've said in each of the programs so far, and on side one of this program, my critical analysis, or the critical analysis I'm presenting here of the Tibet of old, should not be misunderstood as constituting an endorsement for the Chinese communists or what they did or what they are doing, but rather it's by way of assessing the validity and the forthrightness of the Dalai Lama and his associates, who portray the Tibet of old as sort of a paradise on earth due to the fact that the wide open spaces allowed the Buddhists there to sort of realize their dreams of spiritual perfection on earth, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That is not what actually it was going on in the Dalai Lama of in the Tibet of old under the lamas. It was basically a theocracy. And what was life like for that theocracy? We're going to return to an essay by author and social critic Michael Parenti that relates the situation vis-a-vis the old Tibet in considerable detail. Parenti writes, "The greater part of the rural population, some 700,000 of an estimated total of 1,250,000, were serfs. Serfs and other peasants generally were little better than slaves. They went without schooling or medical care. They spent most of their time laboring for high-ranking lamas or for the secular landed aristocracy. Their masters told them what crops to grow and what animals to raise. They could not get married without the consent of their lord or lama, and they might easily be separated from their families should their owners send them to work in a distant location. One 22-year-old woman, herself a runaway serf, reports, "Pretty serf girls were usually taken by the owner as house servants and used as he wished," unquote. They, quote, "were just slaves without rights," unquote. Serfs needed permission to go anywhere. Landowners had legal authority to capture those who tried to flee. One 24-year-old runaway welcomed the Chinese intervention as a, quote, "liberation," unquote. He claimed that under serfdom, he was subjected to incessant toil, hunger, and cold. After his third failed escape, he was mercilessly beaten by the landlord's men until blood poured from his nose and his mouth. They then poured alcohol and caustic soda on his wounds to increase the pain. The serfs were under a lifetime bond to work for the lord's land or the monastery's land without pay to repair the lord's houses, transport his crops, and collect his firewood. They were also expected to provide carrying animals and transportation on demand. They were taxed upon getting married, taxed for the birth of each child and for every death in the family. They were taxed for planting a tree in their yard and for keeping animals. There were taxes for religious festivals, for singing, dancing, drumming, and bell ringing. People were taxed for being sent to prison and upon being released. Those who could not find work were taxed for being unemployed, and if they traveled to another village in search of work, they paid a passage tax. When people could not pay, the monasteries lent them money at 20% to 50% interest. Some debts were handed down from father to son to grandson. Debtors who could not meet their obligations risked being placed into slavery sometimes for the rest of their lives. The theocracy's religious teachings buttressed its class order. The poor and afflicted were taught that they had brought their troubles upon themselves because of their wicked ways in previous lives. Hence, they had to accept the misery of their present existence as a karmic atonement and in anticipation that their lot would improve upon being reborn. The rich and powerful, of course, treated their good fortune as a reward for and tangible evidence of virtue in past and present lives. In the Dalai Lama's Tibet, torture and mutilation, including eye gouging, the pulling out of tongues, hamstringing, and amputation, were favored punishments inflicted upon runaway serfs and thieves. Journeying through Tibet in the 1960s, Stewart and Roma Gelder interviewed a former serf, Tsere Wangtue, who had stolen two sheep belonging to a monastery. For this, he had both his eyes gouged out and his hand mutilated beyond use. He explains that he no longer is a Buddhist, quote, "When a holy lama told them to blind me, I thought there was no good in religion," unquote. Since it was against Buddhist teachings to take human life, some offenders were severely lashed and then left to God, unquote, in the freezing night to die. The parallels between Tibet and medieval Europe are striking, unquote, concludes Tom Grunfeld in his book on Tibet. In 1959, Anna Louise Strong visited an exhibition on torture equipment that had been used by the Tibetan overlords. There were handcuffs of all sizes, including small ones for children, and instruments for cutting off noses and ears, gouging out eyes, and breaking off hands. There were instruments for slicing off kneecaps and heels or hamstringing legs. There were hot brands, whips, and special implements for disemboweling. The exhibition presented photographs and testimonies of victims who had been blinded or crippled or suffered amputations for thievery. There was the shepherd whose master owed him a reimbursement in yuan and wheat, but refused to pay. So he took one of the master's cows. For this, he had his hand severed. Another herdsman, who opposed having his wife taken away from him by his lord, had his hands broken off. There were pictures of communist activists with noses and upper lips cut off, and a woman who was raped and then had her nose sliced away. Early visitors to Tibet also commented about the theocratic despotism. In 1895, an Englishman, Dr. A. L. Waddell, wrote that the populace was under, quote, "the intolerable tyranny of monks," unquote, and the devil superstitions they had fashioned to terrorize the people. In 1904, Percival Landon described the Dalai Lama's rule as an engine of oppression, unquote. At about that time, another English traveler, Captain W.F.T. O'Connor, observed that, quote, the great landowners and the priests exercise such in their, each in their own dominion, a despotic power from which there is no appeal, unquote, while the people are oppressed by the most monstrous growth of monasticism and priestcraft. Tibetan rulers, quote, invented degrading legends and stimulated a spirit of superstition among the common people. And Parenti goes on to cite plenty of other critics who had basically made the same sort of observation about Tibet under the rule of the lamas. Let's just say paradise on earth it most assuredly wasn't. It is not, I think, insignificant that in trying to obtain positive statements, fond remembrances about the Tibet of old, so to speak, the Dalai Lama basically called on the services not only of two former SS officers who were close to him, but one of them a former war criminal from Auschwitz, or former war criminal, an Auschwitz war criminal. And given the nature of Tibetan society, the feudal nature of Tibetan society, certainly that is not the sort of social structure that would be altogether alien or distasteful to someone of SS persuasion. Again, note that the manipulation between the public relations image of old Tibet prior to the Chinese communist invasion and the reality, that brutal feudal society, is once again testimony to the Christopher Hitchens observation that the main success of modern public relations is that it can basically, that it does lead to, it achieves the transcendent success of having one's words and actions judged by one's reputation rather than the other way around. Now, what we're going to do is to take a look at some of the Dalai Lama's other associations and some of the other elements with which he keeps company. We're going to take a look, first of all, we're going to review something that is in that Parenti essay about Tibet, namely something that's really fairly well known, which is the long-standing relationship between the Dalai Lama's Tibetan exile community, the same one that sponsored that conference involving the SS officers that we spoke about last week and to a certain extent this week. In this essay, Michael Parenti cites the long-standing CIA support for the Tibetan government in exile. However, throughout the 1960s, the Tibetan exile community was secretly pocketing $1.7 million a year from the CIA, according to documents released by the State Department in 1998. Once this fact was publicized, the Dalai Lama's organization itself issued a statement admitting that it had received millions of dollars from the CIA during the 1960s to send armed squads of exiles into Tibet to undermine the Maoist revolution. The Dalai Lama's annual payment from the CIA was $186,000. Indian intelligence also financed both him and other Tibetan exiles. He has refused to say whether he or his brothers worked for the CIA. The agency has also declined to comment. So again, the relationship between the Dalai Lama and his, yes, milieu and elements of intelligence is really quite well known. Something that I'm going to put in the description for the program, but due to the limitations of time, I'm not going to talk about. Here are some other very un-Dalai-like things that the Dalai Lama has done, in addition to his association with SS people and war criminals and Shoko Asahara of the Aum Shinrikyo cult, who also was a devotee of Hitler's to a certain extent. The Dalai Lama has done things like endorsing Pakistani nuclear development and lobbying enthusiastically for the release from custody of former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet. Again, very un-Dalai-like things, but things that are usually subsumed by his excellent PR-structured reputation rather than leading people to think carefully about what it is that they're looking at. What we're going to do now is we're going to Dalai out, so to speak, and we're going to take a look at the associations of the Dalai Lama and how they not only fit into an apparent covert action paradigm, But in particular, we're going to take a look at the Dalai Lama's association with elements who are pushing for independent states in Central Asia, areas that were formerly part of the Soviet Union are now part of Russia, and also in particular areas that were part of China. The elements with which the Dalai Lama is associating are not only Muslim, but in some cases Islamist. They are also, as we'll see this week and next week, elements that also have a heritage tracking through the Third Reich. And indeed, we're going to Dalai out, so to speak. The camera's going to Dalai out, and we're going to see how the Dalai Lama and his Buddhist milieu, although Buddhist belongs in quotes, really, in my opinion, fit into a larger covert action milieu that's aiming at setting up independent, I would say puppet states, but certainly independent ethnic states in what are now parts of Russia and China. These states are energy rich. They are primarily Muslim in population. And I believe that what we're looking at is yet another classic exercise in geopolitics and in using the Muslim and other ethnic populations of the Earth Island to gain control of the central part of Asia, which was seen as the key to controlling that giant landmass stretching from Europe all the way across most of the Middle East, what used to be the Soviet Union, China, India, and Pakistan. And again, we've spoken about the Earth Island concept many times in the past. If you're unclear about what that is, go to the Spitfire website, look up Earth Island, and check it out in the many programs that I've done about that. Now, what we're going to do is to explore at greater length and in a much more leisurely fashion the links between the Dalai Lama and East Turkmenistani activists, unquote. If you haven't heard of East Turkmenistan, well, there's a reason for that. First of all, it doesn't really exist. It's actually Xinjiang province of China, but it does have a large Muslim population of a group of people called the Uyghurs, spelled U-I-G-H-U-R. Now, the Uyghurs are Muslims. Elements of the Uyghur community have been active within the Islamo-fascist global community. Elements have been active with Muslim Brotherhood offshoots like Al-Qaeda and others. And other elements of the Uyghur separatist community are of a more secular, pan-Turkist separatist activist mode, so to speak. Not only the Muslim Brotherhood and that element that appeals to the Uyghurs, but also the pan-Turkist movement, as we've seen in, among other programs, RFA 14 and RFA 21, have, again, a political heritage tracking through the Third Reich. We're going to take a look now at some of the individuals who are on the board of the Dalai Lama Foundation. First is a guy named Erkin Optekin. Erkin Optekin is one of the foremost human rights advocates for the Uyghur people of eastern Turkestan, also known as the Xinjiang Autonomous Region of the People's Republic of China. Mr. Optekin was employed by Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty from 1971 to 1994. He is one of the founders of the Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization, or UNPO, and currently serves as its general secretary. That group, by the way, is not officially part of the United Nations, but its advocates represent it as sort of a shadow UN for unrepresented people. It is recognized by the UN as a human rights activist organization. What it appears to be is a pan-Turkist intelligence front, frankly, among others. It's more than pan-Turkist, actually, an intelligence front utilizing, in the case of the East Turkmenistanis, Turkic-speaking peoples. But as we're going to see, not only in this program, but in future discussions, the Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization, based in The Hague, looks very much like one of these NGOs that is a fount for covert operations. And one of the key members of the Dalai Lama Foundation is Erkin Optekin, who, by the way, worked for Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty for almost a quarter of a century, both institutions closely connected with the CIA and other U.S. intelligence services. Also very close to the old milieu of the Galen Organization, the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, and other institutions that have links to the pan-Turkist movement. Another interesting person is Joe Firmage, a Silicon Valley entrepreneur who's also a big booster of The Aliens Are Coming. Richard Gere, the famed movie actor, is yet another member of the Dalai Lama Foundation. We're going to look at Gere again, another person who ostensibly at least and perhaps sincerely espouses peace, but when you look at the causes that he gets involved with, they are causes whether as a matter of deliberation or caprice, just happen to dovetail with Islamist activism and with that element of U.S. intelligence that appears to be still actively promoting Islamism in parts of the former Soviet Union in the Middle East, particularly areas where there were secular leftist or Stalinist governments. We're going to talk about Richard Gere and some of the things he's been involved with in programs to come. But another member of the directors of the Dalai Lama Foundation, one of the key people in the Dalai Lama Foundation, is one Michael Van Walt. He's described here. Michael Van Walt currently serves as executive president of the Peace Action Council and legal advisor to the office of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. From 1991 to 98, Dr. Van Walt was General Secretary of UNPO, the Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization. That's the same organization that was founded in part by Erkin Alptekin, who, along with his father, the late Isa Yusuf Alptekin, was very active in the Pan-Turkist movement. By the way, Erkin Alptekin is a German citizen. His father has parks and other landmarks named for him in Istanbul. So in taking a look at the East Turkmenistan independence movement, it has an Islamist element linked with the Muslim Brotherhood. We're going to look at that. It also has a secular Pan-Turkist Uyghur separatist element that, as we're going to see next week, has a heritage running back through the Third Reich and forward through Western intelligence elements very active in the Cold War. Now, before we go back to the subject of the Dalai Lama per se and his links with people like Erkin Alptekin and the East Turkmenistani separatist movement, we're going to take a quick look at the head of the Unrepresented Peoples Organization, the UNPO, Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization. Reviewing from something we looked at last week, and again, for people that are perhaps shaking their heads or for people who may have admired the Dalai Lama and are feeling bent out of shape, as we take a look at who presides over the Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization, which not only has a prominent Tibetan component, but also East Turkmenistanis and others, and as we'll see in future weeks, has some Native American tribes, which may suggest at least the possibility of a destabilization of the United States somewhere down the line. The head of UNPO, the eldest son and heir of the dynasty, is Karl, who lives in Austria and has served in the Austrian army and was a member of the European Parliament like his father from 1996 to 1999. He, Karl von Habsburg, has worked hard to keep the family in the public limelight, even hosting a popular television game show. He works quietly to change the Austrian laws of 1919 that forbid the Habsburgs from holding any political office and has often been mentioned as a possible chancellor of the Austrian Republic. At this time, he is the general director of the UNPO, United Nations and Peoples Organization. In 1993, Karl married Francesca Thiessen-Bornemisza, who is well known in European high society. And still more about the milieu of Erkin Alptekin of the Dalai Lama Foundation and the UNPO and Radio Europe and Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, we read as follows. Now, this is from an Indian intelligence report put together by an intelligence and military-related think tank in India. The full URL for this will be listed in the printed description for the program. Now, of the Dalai Lama and his association with both secular separatist pan-Turkist East Turkmenistani elements and Islamist separatists, this intelligence report states, India should have reasons to be concerned over the Dalai Lama's hobnobbing with the pan-Islamic elements in Xinjiang. One cannot avoid suspecting that the influence of these elements must have been behind his participation in a conference organized in Chennai last year by some elements which have been acting as apologists for General Pervez Musharraf, the Pakistani military dictator, which was attended by a representative of Hurriyat of J&K and a large numbers of Pakistanis, some of them retired Pakistani military officers. The Dalai Lama's setup subsequently denied or played down some of the controversial remarks attributed to him at the conference. The government of India should consider conveying to the Dalai Lama its unhappiness and concern over his association with pan-Islamic elements in Xinjiang. Skipping yet more from that report. The Islamic movement of Uzbekistan and Abu Sayyaf of the southern Philippines have been designated as foreign terrorist organizations under the U.S. law of 1996, but not the Eastern Turkestan Islamic Party, though all three are members of Osama bin Laden's International Islamic Front for Jihad against the USA and Israel. In initiating action either for designation as a foreign terrorist organization or for action under the UN Security Council Resolution number 1373 in respect of bank accounts, the U.S. and the European Union have focused essentially on terrorist organizations which are perceived by them as international in nature or which are seen as posing a threat to their nationals and interests. Terrorist organizations viewed by them as purely indigenous have been excluded. These multiple yardsticks have been used vis-a-vis China as well as India. And then after a discussion, then talking about some of these separatist elements, talking about the similarity in that both the secular and the Islamic separatists have received intelligence support, note the role played in this milieu by the CIA and other elements of Western intelligence. The second similarity relates to the external causes of aggravation of the terrorist violence in Xinjiang. Just as in J&K and Xinjiang too, there are two distinct terrorist and extremist movements, one resorting to violence on ethnic grounds to assert the Uyghur ethnic identity against the perceived Han Chinese domination, and the other using religious and pan-Islamic arguments to justify violence for the establishment of an independent Islamic state. While the ethnic separatist elements have been the beneficiaries of sympathy and support from the Dalai Lama setup and the Tibetan diaspora abroad and the U.S., Taiwanese, and Turkish intelligence services, the religious fundamentalist elements have been in receipt of support from the Inter-Services Intelligence Agency, or ISI-backed jihadist organizations in Pakistan, the Taliban, and bin Laden's International Islamic Front for Jihad against the USA and Israel. And note the following. In the 1970s and the 1980s, the Central Intelligence Agency of the USA has built up a network of contacts with the Uyghur separatist elements, and some of those who had in the past worked for the Munich-based Radio Liberty of the CIA, such as Erkin Alptekin, chairman of the Europe-based Eastern Turkestani Union and a close Uyghur associate of the Dalai Lama, are now in the forefront of the ethnic separatist movement. And in weeks to come, we're going to take a look not only at a review of the pan-Turkist movement and its historical links, but we're going to take a look, too, at not only the Habsburgs and some of their political links, but we're going to take a look at this UNPO, the Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization, and some of the unrepresented nations and peoples that they purport to represent. And we're going to take a look, too, at how the Habsburgs, of all people, should come to be involved with self-determination movements for Muslims and Buddhists in Asia. Very, very interesting indeed. However, those will be talked about in weeks to come. Please don't forget to look at the description for this program when it's up. The full written description for the Record 548 should be on the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. ere long. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 548, Tibet or Not Tibet. This is being recorded on August 16th of the year 2006. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.